Jake Sock is representing Victor Clark, the defendant in this case. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Victor Clark did not get a fair trial. Unconstitutional joinder put Mr. Clark in a situation where a mountain of irrelevant prejudicial evidence, almost completely unrelated to the case he was charged with initially, came in during his trial.
Did he preserve that issue by appropriately raising it with the lower court?
And I know Your Honor's aware, we argued that he did. The issue was initially raised when joinder was first requested. At that time, there's kind of a convoluted set of circumstances at that time. Not only was the joinder requested about 3.5 weeks before trial was set on the Wells Fargo charges, he was also notified at that time that the lawyer who was prepared to go forward that he had at that time was closing their practice and moving out of state, and he would have to also get a new lawyer if the case was continued. Mr. Clark made a few things very clear at that time through counsel. He did not want to waive speedy, although he ultimately did, and we argue that he was forced to do that through essentially a Hobson's choice. He also argued that at that time, his lawyer basically argued, I'm not prepared because I don't know anything about the request yet to argue the joinder issue. And normally, we would have a preliminary hearing before I would even file a motion for severance. Ultimately, his new counsel did file a motion for severance. And during the trial, the issue came up, as is noted in our brief on page 16, and although that may not be typical objection, it's an issue that was raised during the trial, and it's clear that at that time, Mr. Clark was still objecting to the joinder of the cases.
I was just going to ask counsel, during trial, he did not say, I'm renewing my motion for joinder. He said, I'm renewing my motion to exclude Mr. Edwards' testimony, correct?
Well, and Your Honor, the language that I point to in the brief is the prosecution, this is quoting from the transcript, the prosecution of the two separate and distinct robberies in question must be tried separately.
That wasn't said during the trial, was it? That was a footnote in the motion to exclude that was filed before trial.
No, Your Honor, that's correct. That is part of the motion that was filed prior to trial. So that is correct that during trial, there was not an objection to the joinder.
So how do we get around the Albu case, which makes it, and we're not the Supreme Court, and we got to follow the Supreme Court. They say you have to renew it at trial. I mean, you're telling us it wasn't renewed at trial. Doesn't that end the issue?
Your Honor, What our argument is under these circumstances is that it was objected to multiple times and the position was clear at trial, whether or not that was noted in the transcript of the trial. And I think under the circumstances of this case, it's not possible, I mean, it's certainly possible to find something, but it's not possible in the circumstances of this case and believe that the amount of evidence that came in through the Key Bank robbery allowed Mr. Clark to have a fair trial.
Counsel, didn't the jury acquit him on all of the Key Bank charges?
That's correct.
So how could that have possibly prejudiced him?
Well, Your Honor, it's one thing I don't think Mr. Clark can argue that he was prejudiced on the Key Bank charges, but it's impossible to determine exactly how much prejudice all that information had on the jury, because the fact is they watched a trial and convicted him of some serious charges, and they should have only seen the evidence on the charges from the Key Bank, or I'm sorry, from the Wells Fargo robbery.
The jury was able to sort out which was Key Bank and which was Wells Fargo because there were multiple charges for both of those robberies. And the jury very specifically acquitted him on all the Key Bank charges and very specifically convicted him on at least some of the Wells Fargo charges. So The jury didn't have trouble sorting it out, based on the record.
I don't disagree with Your Honor's statement that the jury didn't have trouble sorting out guilt or innocence between the Wells Fargo charges and the KeyBank charges. Having said that, they had to decide his guilt on the Wells Fargo charges with a mass of information. The evidence that was presented at trial was over twice as much, and there was almost no interrelation between the Wells Fargo and the KeyBank robberies, aside from what Tyrone Edwards provided the court. So to say that Mr. Clark could not have been prejudiced on the Wells Fargo charges on which he was convicted simply because he was not convicted on the related joint charges, that's very different than whether or not the jury was able to determine guilt or innocence distinctly. We're talking about whether or not all those things that they hear about the Wells, about the KeyBank robbery, which was, and when Your Honor look at these two robberies, there really is nothing similar in the two robberies. The Wells Fargo is an inside job. The KeyBank robbery is essentially a Wild West cowboy style bank robbery where someone walks in the door in the midst of business hours, shots are fired, doors are kicked down, people are physically assaulted, a carjacking occurs outside. And what we have here is a Wells Fargo charge which had none of those aspects in it. And when Mr. Clark goes to trial, he now, because of the joinder, has to face all this drama that the DA can put in front of the jury in the KeyBank charges. It's not lost on me that it is unusual, and I don't know that I'll ever see a case quite like this again, that the jury did not convict on the KeyBank. But that does not mean that it did not prejudice the jury on the remaining charges, because the fact is the trials would have been extremely different. I'm sorry.
No, I apologize. I interrupted you. What in the record, I understand your argument, which is, I'll give it back to you to make sure, but the KeyBank, even though it was acquitted, showed that the jury could not possibly have kept that out of their mind and it would have influenced their decision on Wells, I think is what you're telling us.
Yes, right.
And so, what in the record supports that argument? I mean, the problem here is the jury found a reasonable doubt, at least, as to whether your client was involved in KeyBank. So if they weren't sure he was involved, why would they, what leads you to say that had to have prejudiced them on Wells? The best case is they thought there was a reasonable doubt, but first of all, worst case, the best case is they thought he wasn't involved at all. And so what in the record suggests this prejudice you're talking about?
Well, and our part of that is from looking at the major characters involved in this case. I mean, you have Victor Clark, who has a prior conviction on his record for bank robbery, so the jury doesn't know about that at trial. So to the jury, he is an angel compared to Tyrone Edwards. Tyrone Edwards is basically telling the jury, and I don't think he uses the terms, I'm a professional bank robber, but it's clear from his testimony that this is what he does. He, at the time, although the jury did not hear about all of his criminal history, the jury was aware that he had currently been charged with four other bank robberies in about the same span of time. He was a gunman. He goes into banks with a gun and tries to get money. And I think it's easy for the jury to look at the KeyBank robbery and say, well, this is what Mr. Edwards does. It looks like that was probably his thing. But then Mr. Edwards, who comes to the jury saying, well, this is actually my boss over here. They have all this background information now on what a bad guy Mr. Edwards is and how Victor Clark is his boss, essentially, is what Mr. Edwards is testifying to. And the DA could not have approached the case the same way without the information about the KeyBank robbery. They couldn't have painted the same picture of just how dangerous Mr. Edwards was, and i.e. also how dangerous Mr. Clark is, because this is his boss. Now, you have Mr. Edwards without the KeyBank robbery, he's going to say, Mr. Clark is my boss. But he can't talk about all this violent mayhem, because the Wells Fargo robbery basically was a, just about, if people hadn't started talking to the cops, a perfectly planned bank robbery. An inside job that went just as planned until Tyrone Edwards attracted attention because of his other exploits.
Before I run out of time, I just wanted to get to an issue that does not have a preservation problem for you, and that's the cross-examination. What questions was defendant foreclosed from asking on cross-examination that he couldn't get into because of the court's ruling, and what, if any, prejudice resulted from those specific questions?
And so we've kind of already gotten into this, Your Honor, just how significant Tyrone Edwards was in whichever story you're telling between these two bank robbers. It's hard, without being the lawyer who reviews the discovery in the case, to know how much damage could have been done to Tyrone Edwards and the story that he was telling the jury about Mr. Clark being his boss, without knowing all the discovery. And we don't have that luxury on appeal. At a minimum, the issue that brought this to the court's attention was his exploits out of state, and the fact that he, in passing, even though his lawyer did not want him to, had let it drop during his proffer with the police that he had thrown the gun away he used, and my mind is, I'm not sure if it was the Wells Fargo, the Keys Bank, or both of those robberies. I think it was the Wells Fargo. And he had tossed that gun out a window in a police chase in North Carolina. And the ruling essentially was that defense counsel could not go into any of the details other than what Tyrone Edwards was willing to say, which was, I left the state. Later on, I realized this guy shorted me, which a lot of the things Tyrone Edwards is telling the jury are implausible to highly fantastic, because not most people take off if they think they haven't been paid. But he tells the jury he left the state, later realized he had not been paid, comes back, and lives with the person who had not paid him, and then they plan the Key Bank robbery. There are a lot of things about what Tyrone Edwards was up to, whether or not that had any bearing on why he was motivated to tell the story that he told.
What impact did that have on the Wells Fargo charges?
Well, and again, Tyrone Edwards is a star witness in both of these cases, or I should say both of these sets of charges. Mm-hmm. So Tyrone Edwards provides a letter that was never authenticated. He provides the lion's share of the incriminating testimony against Mr. Clark. And that is also on the Wells Fargo case, not just the Key Bank robbery. So he is probably, I think, the most significant witness in the case. Go ahead, Graham.
I understand you think he's very important. I get that from your briefs and from your argument. But what questions would have been asked or could have been asked that weren't allowed to be asked that would have been of any use or would have had any significance, I should say? With the Wells Fargo charges.
And again, it's hard for me, and I don't want to sound like I'm copying out here, because mm-hmm. the line of questioning that I imagine would have to happen would be into why did he really go to North Carolina? Is he telling the truth, or were there other things that drew him out there? Because what he's saying is, the only reason he came back is because that guy's in charge and he didn't pay me. So I think that's the line of questioning that would have had to occur by defense counsel, and they weren't really allowed to get into, okay, why'd you go to North Carolina? Why not somewhere else? Why were you willing to come back to North Carolina? What's happening in North Carolina?
But what difference is it? What difference does what he's doing in North Carolina make to the testimony he gives concerning the Wells Fargo Bank, particularly since I believe the record shows your client sent him a check after he claimed he'd been shorted, correct?
That's correct.
All right, well, doesn't that, provide strong collaboration for him being shorted?
It arguably could. It could also provide collaboration that Mr. Clark doesn't want to get shot. It doesn't mean that he actually owes him money. And the jury could draw a number of conclusions from that.
Well, perhaps I misspoke. What difference does it make what he's doing in North Carolina?
In your to confront someone, you're supposed to be able to ask them the questions you want with the checks and balances of objection and the court's ruling on those questions. And what we have here was Tyrone Edwards was basically brokered his testimony beforehand, and the public defender was not able to go after him. He was not able, other than his criminal charges and why he'd taken the plea agreement because of his criminal charges, able to go into the history of relationship with Mr. Clark, why he was in North Carolina. He was very limited on what he could go into. And I don't think, without looking at the discovery, that I can give your honors extremely specific answers about how important that was going to be, because they weren't allowed to do it.
I know your time is up, but did the court preclude all this evidence? I mean, I remember the court specifically said, you can't ask where the gun is. You could ask if he discarded it. And so you're suggesting that the court, there's this Gregg suppression, and I'm embarrassed to say, I may be just wrong. I don't remember that. Was there some big preclusion order that limited the testimony, as you said? Because the only thing I remember from the briefs is, you can't ask him where the gun is. Everything else seemed to be fair game, and he was cross-examined on why he came back from North Carolina. So it's a very specific question. Is there a preclusion order here keeping all this stuff out?
There is no written preclusion order, Your Honor. The order is from the transcripts. But the order was basically an agreement on regarding the issues from North Carolina and why he was chased by the police, what he did with the gun, what he was up to there. None of that could be gone into.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Michael McMaster, registration number 42368, on behalf of the people. Mr. Clark contends that the trial court erred in denying his motion to sever. However, this claim was waived because he failed to raise it at trial, or he failed to re-raise it at trial. He's argued that an objection he made during trial to Mr. Edwards' testimony incorporated the pretrial motion, which contained a footnote, which then referenced a separate motion, which renewed his original motion to sever. This at-trial objection is simply too attenuated and circuitous to alert the trial court that he's re-raising that issue, and that in light of the evidence presented at trial, that he now has that necessary prejudice to allow for that severance under Rule 14. It's simply insufficient to constitute preservation.
Mr. McMaster, I certainly understand your argument on this. Let me just ask you, if we were to get to the merits, I'm having a lot of trouble understanding how this res gestae ruling works. I mean, if we got to the merits on this, I can understand why the Wells Fargo robbery would be the res gestae of the Key Bank, because it explains why that whole instance, explain why it came back and they robbed the bank. I'm having trouble understanding how it works the other way, which the court seemed to rule. Likewise on the 404B, it's kind of tenuous. So we got to the merits. Could you help me understand how they're admissible, when the one instance is admissible in the other trial, specifically how KeyBank is admissible in the Wells Fargo robbery?
So there's cross admissibility between the two robberies because it explains the complete story.
Why does KeyBank explain Wells Fargo? I get why Wells Fargo explains KeyBank.
So the evidence shows that Mr. Edwards returned to Colorado because he was shorted on his share of the proceeds from the Wells Fargo's robbery. The evidence showed he was short on money, and when he returned, Mr. Clark was short on money. And then they both commit the second robbery, or Mr. Edwards commits the second robbery. That second robbery provides a complete story as to the first one with respect to the amount of money that they received. The evidence showed that they were expecting about $200,000. They only received, I think it was around $100,000, or they only were able to steal $100,000. So that second robbery, which is motivated by that need for money or lack of money, explains and proves that first robbery. it's a continuous story, and it also further explains the relationship between Mr. Edwards and Mr. Clark. Mr. Clark operates as, for lack of a better word, a bank robbery mastermind. His MO is to use Mr. Edwards as the gunman to go in and rob the banks. He organizes it, he arranges different people to perform different functions, he provides transportation, they do this planning in his retail store. After the robbery, he provides getaway vehicles, or at least a plan to get away, if it's successful, which wasn't the case in KeyBank, but, and they return to his retail store where he disperses the funds. These were all part of the same story, and it was continuous between both Wells Fargo and KeyBank. I think that analysis applies both to the Res Geste and the 44B, and I would disagree with Your Honor that it's tenuous. As with the motion to sever, Mr. Clark's argument that his right to speedy trial was violated was also waived. This is an issue which he did not raise at trial. He didn't file a motion to dismiss, and he also agreed to the trial schedule. Those are three different ways that he can waive the argument, which he did. However, were this court to reach the merits, Mr. Clark voluntarily waived speedy trial once those additional charges were amended. Perhaps it was a hard choice, but it was still a choice made nonetheless. I'd also like to note that Mr. Clark doesn't raise a separate constitutional speedy trial claim. His argument, the substance of the argument, is that of the statute. He makes a drive-by citation to the Constitution, but that's insufficient to raise that claim.
Did he talk about it in the trial court or on appeal?
On appeal.
Did he raise the constitutional issue in the trial court?
No, he did not. Again, that's why the issue is waived. Finally, I'm happy to provide any clarification I can to the third argument with respect to what he was limited to in cross-examination of Mr. Edwards, but as I said in the brief, the only limitation that the trial court provided was that Mr. Clark was unable to ask Mr. Edwards where he ditched the gun. The reason was that Mr. Edwards was testifying pursuant to a plea deal that only had binding effect here in Colorado. Were he to incriminate himself in a different state, he wouldn't have the benefit of that plea agreement in that other state. So that was the only limitation that, at least I'm aware of, Judge Gabriel, that you and I share the same memory of the record. So he was free to ask anything else. These other questions that he now is presenting here, at least in oral argument, he was free to ask those questions. And in the answer brief, I think I quoted some of those questions he, in fact, did ask. So I'm not sure how else to respond to Mr. Clark's argument there. Unless the court has any other questions, people respectfully request that this court affirm Mr. Clark's convictions. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course.